Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you've all enjoyed an early lunch and good afternoon. Look, today I'm delighted to welcome the RBA's Deputy Governor, Andrew Houser, to our conference. Andrew and I will be having a fireside chat on the Australian economy and all things related to monetary policy. But before we get going, a little bit of background on our esteemed guest. So Andrew left the United Kingdom earlier this year to join the RBA as Deputy Governor, which means he's a member of the RBA board as well as its Deputy Chair. So whilst most of us in the room are consistently speculating on the outlook for interest rates and the outlook for monetary policy more generally, Andrew is the only person in the room who actually has a say and vote over the stance of monetary policy in Australia. Andrew's a career central banker, and before he joined the Reserve Bank, spent around 30 years with the Bank of England, otherwise affectionately nicknamed the Old Lady of Threadneedle Street. Andrew's most recent position at the Bank of England was Executive Director for Markets. He's also held senior roles across most of the bank's major functions, including leading its inflation report, its international economic analysis, and its regional agencies' intelligence gathering. Andrew has studied the potent trifecta of philosophy, politics, and economics, and he holds degrees from both Oxford University and the London School of Economics. Finally, I think you'll all agree that Andrew is one of the most charismatic central bankers going around today, and that, I think, is a good thing indeed. So, ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in giving a warm round of applause to our Deputy Governor, Andrew Houser.
I got a woo from over there. Wasn't
there you go, fan club.
Thanks to my press office there.
And look, I should say as well that once Andrew and I complete the fireside, we will open up to the room for questions. And can I just ask if members of the media allow our delegates to go first from the conference before asking any questions? So, Andrew, I thought I'd kick off with a couple of questions related to the labour market, given we got out the employment report last week, which was jobs data for September. And the ABS threw up a strong set of numbers. We saw that employment increased by 65,000 over the month. The unemployment rate held firm at 4.1%, and participation hit a record high. We do know these numbers are choppy month to month, but if we look at them over a 3-4 month period now, they've been quite strong. Can I ask, have you been surprised by the strength of employment growth in the context of pretty weak GDP growth?
Well, and thanks, Gareth, and thanks to everyone for the invitation. Let's start, like all good forecasts, with what we haven't been surprised by. And broadly speaking, we haven't been surprised by unemployment. And unemployment, of course, is the traditional measure, perhaps too traditional, of tightness in the labour market. Given that we haven't been surprised particularly by unemployment, it is perhaps surprising that we have been, yes, a bit surprised by the strength of employment growth, as I think probably you have and most other people commenting on it. That conjunction of inline unemployment with surprisingly strong employment growth is explained by, and stop me when this gets too tedious or nerdy or no, you know this stuff, high participation. And in fact, strikingly high participation, both by comparison with Australia's past and also most other countries as well. I mean, it has to be said, and maybe this doesn't get said enough, it's quite a good news story, these labour market outcomes, both the level of unemployment at or near historical lows and pretty low by international comparison, the level of labour market participation high and having risen. Part of our mandate is to deliver something close to full employment. What do we think is going on here? Well, I mean, I'd actually be interested to hear your views as well. I know you wrote about this sort of last week. There's a number of different interpretations you could put on it. It might be telling us that demand conditions in the economy are a bit stronger than the activity measure is telling us. That's a little bit of a heroic story. I know it's not your story at the CBA at the moment because activity data is so weak. But most of us are expecting activity to recover this year on the back of the tax cuts and the decline in the headwinds from inflation. You know, so it may be that companies are looking ahead to what they expect to be rather stronger demand conditions and saying, you know, do you know what, we want to keep employing. Obviously, some of these jobs, we don't know how many yet in this quarter, because the data, as you know, aren't coming out for a few weeks, but some of these jobs are either directly or indirectly related to public sector, and those may have slightly different drivers. But at least on the most recent data, you know, employment in the private sector was growing as well. So I think there's that demand story. The other story, which perhaps isn't as positive, is that this is telling us that actually the supply side of the economy is relatively weak, and that either these employees are going into jobs where they're not able to produce very much, or that companies are struggling to secure the people they need to produce the output that they need. And so I think it's actually a good example, I'm sure we'll come back to this, of how, you know, what superficially it looks like pretty straightforward number is telling you that the economy is going gangbusters, so hey, let's, you know, don't do X, Y, and Z. Actually, when you pare it back and strip it down, is capable of a number of different interpretations. But to your basic question, were we surprised by the number? Yes.
Yeah. And you did mention during that, I think you said, or used the words, the effect, you know, it was good news. Can I ask you specifically then, around your reaction when you see numbers like that, do you think when they hit the screen or if you're in front of a terminal, geez, this is great, unemployment isn't going up much, and you said it's coming in broadly in line with the bank's central scenario, do you think, oh, that means we might need to keep policy restrictive for a prolonged period because of the strength in the labour market, or do you lean into the data and say, look, this is a good news story that appears to be unfolding with respect to low unemployment? Can we keep it as low as possible if the inflation and wages data moves directionally the way we'd like to see?
I think you've just answered your own question there, to be honest.
It's always good to get confirmation.
If you've understood what I've just said to you, I'll give you the Greenspan quote. So, look, we're just about going into the next forecast round at the RBA, and so I'd make two points, really, in terms of the implication of this number for the outlook. We're data dependent, but we're not data obsessed, right? I mean, we have to take that number in the context of everything else. Activity, as you say, has been weak. It's been really very weak. We haven't seen the inflation number for the third quarter, or I call it third quarter, I think we call the September quarter here yet. It's not coming out in a week or two. And so we have to put all those numbers into the hopper and take a view about what it means for the outlook for inflation. So we haven't done that process yet. Sure. So I'm a bit nervous about giving an indication. I could give you an indication that's almost certainly turned out to be wrong. I think the other point, which is that perhaps the deeper point, part of the forecast process, part of the discussion as well, as you say, is that there are different interpretations you can put on that strong number. If it's telling you about strong demand, it will give you one implication for the outlook for inflation and therefore policy. If it's telling you about relatively weak supply, it might give you a different implication. So those are things we have to look at.
Sure. And so on that, given, and you did touch on the composition of jobs growth before, and we do know that obviously the labour account will give us a full idea of where those jobs have come from in the September quarter, albeit it doesn't come out until early December. But if we look at, say, over the last 12 months or so, we've seen the bulk of jobs growth has come in the non-market sector, particularly health and education. When you're looking and assessing the labour market from a cyclical perspective, do you put much weight on the composition of jobs growth, or do you simply take the view that, you know, a job is a job?
So basically it's the latter, right? Yep. It's basically a job is a job. It is a claim on resources in the economy. And, you know, you see that very vividly. I'm sure you do this through your own work at the CBA. But I go out and about. I'm trying to go out and about a lot because it's an economy I don't yet understand well at all. Both, you know, locally in New South Wales and into the states as well. And when you talk to firms, what you're hearing, I think, is you're hearing, obviously, there are a range of firms who are in difficulties, there are a range of firms who are doing better, there's always a spread. But on average, firms are still telling us that whilst labour market conditions have become a bit easier, it's still more or less the top factor constraining output growth. If when you ask people what is really holding you back from providing more goods, their supply, whether it's goods or services, and in general, the number one answer is still mostly securing the right number and the right quality of labour. And that's because the labour market's fungible, right? It's not perfectly fungible. A doctor, you know, might not go and do burger flipping or vice versa, although we saw some of that in the UK. You said that, not me. We perhaps no one else heard that. We saw some of that in the UK where people went and did radically different things as Eastern Europe opened up. But by and large, it's happening less here. But you do hear a lot of feedback from firms who say, you know, I need to get traders to do this or I need to get people to do that. And they're being pulled away by some rival activity, which might be, it might have been, perhaps not now, is mining. It might have been infrastructure construction. It might have been another activity, the Brisbane Olympics, you name it. And people are all competing for those scarce resources. And so that's, I think, a good reason why, in general, I'm sure you do the same, you start from assuming that the demand for labour is the demand for labour in a homogeneous way. That said, you're always going to get sectors that are growing. You're always going to get sectors that are shrinking or not growing as rapidly, and that composition can tell you things, for example, about the mix of productivity. It can tell you things about the shape and nature of expenditure in the economy. So we do look at the breakdown, but when you're actually looking at the outlook for inflation, we start from the assumption that a job is a job.
Okay, that's quite helpful. And look, you did mention about, you know, firms, I guess on average, saying they're still finding it hard to get the right labour, which is quite an interesting thing for firms to be saying when we've had, you know, 18 months or so of real consumer spending going backwards per person. That's obviously backward looking. There's a lot of focus, I think, with analysts at the moment trying to work out what's been going on in the economy over the last few months from a spending perspective, given we had the stage three tax cuts come in, which means consumers obviously get an income boost, or those workers rather. But we want to work out, you know, what has been the response to that income boost from a spending perspective. And I guess to complicate things, we're getting a few different signals from, depending on which data you're actually looking at. Retail trade looks a little bit stronger than the ABS measure of household consumption, or their monthly indicator. All the different banks are putting out their own spending data. Have you got what's your assessment so far of what you think might be going on in the September quarter?
Yeah, well, it feels like half the analysts, economists in the RBA at the moment are poring over these data, as you say, to try and get a clearer sense of whether that pickup in consumption growth that even you, I think, were expecting at some point this year, and certainly, you know, certainly we were, is actually coming through or not. The picture at the moment is noisy, as you know. And actually, you know, I think it's probably clear that the pickup wasn't as immediate as you could have assumed in the most extreme assumption. You know, the moment that people got rebates, they went out and spent it. That probably doesn't look like what has happened. Perhaps that was never very realistic. But there have been some stronger signs, particularly as weeks have gone through. And, you know, and then the question is, well, if the pickup's slightly delayed, does that telling you something that consumption overall is not going to pick up as strongly, or it's just going to be a bit slower? And we're working, you know, to be honest, we're working that through at the moment. I think you can pay your money and take your choice on the measures. It isn't quite as clear either way.
Yeah, look, I completely agree on that front. And I suppose in that context, we'll look to the national accounts to give us clarity one way or the other on what happened or what has happened in the September quarter. I wanted to ask a question about the latest set of minutes that relate to the September board meeting. I think it was one of those sets of minutes that I think there was something for almost every analyst in there, depending on, you know, what side of the fence you might be sitting on.
Yours, I think, said we were doing a good interpretation of the classic two-handed economist, which I don't think it was praise, was it?
No, well, I'm glad you read, though.
We read everything.
Yeah. Well, I think too that there was a lot of on the one hand, on the other hand, and we all do that as economists.
I said that I wouldn't do the joke, Gareth. I wouldn't do the joke.
I walked into it.
That you were going to ask two questions for every one this time, on the grounds that the CBA was charging me twice every time this weekend. But there you go.
We might just
that's
get straight.
Some hisses. That's got some hisses in the room.
We might just get straight onto fiscal policy then.
Okay. Oh, this is rapidly escalating.
All right. Let's go back to the minutes. Look, there was a few scenarios that were discussed in the minutes around what might see policy less restrictive, more restrictive, or rates held at a restrictive level for a prolonged period of time. I think a lot of market participants are kind of well aware of scenarios that could see rates have to be tightened further or at least held at a restrictive level for longer, given that has probably been the communication we've had most of the tightening cycle until recently. And that's why when I read the September board minutes, what stood out to me was a discussion on a couple of scenarios that could see rates less restrictive or policy less restrictive. There were two. One said a weaker economy than expected, either via more household savings, therefore less GDP growth driving down inflation more than otherwise, or a sharply weakening labour market doing the same thing. I suppose in some sense we've kind of covered off a few of those things. But what caught my eye was the second scenario, which said less persistent inflation even without weaker than expected activity. So am I right in basically assuming here or inferring that as long as inflation is coming back to target more quickly, then we don't necessarily need to see any further weakening in the labour market or more weakness in GDP growth to result in policy being less restrictive than it currently is?
Oh my gosh, I couldn't follow all of that. that was my own minute, so can't really criticise. Let me. And I don't know if I'm going to answer your question, but if I don't, I'm sure you'll tell me. What we were trying to do in those minutes is make it clear. And I don't know that, and to your two-handed point, I'm not sure that it was a statement of anything other than the bleedingly obvious, right?
Sure.
That we were acutely conscious that the outlook is uncertain and that the world could develop in a number of different ways. You did pick out the downside scenarios. Yep. Obviously, the minutes did highlight that there are upside scenarios too. There are some nasty ones, right, particularly if the supply side proves to be even weaker and you could get a world where activity continues to weaken and inflation doesn't fall back. That would be an unattractive place
to be.
Maybe that's the one you're talking about. We hope that isn't where we get to, but it is a possibility. But I think we wanted to send a very clear signal that we are, you know, policy is ready to respond in either direction. Either direction, but policy is ready to respond. You don't want to get into the place where people think these guys are on autopilot. They're not looking at the data. They're not forming a view about the outlook. They're giving some sort of, you know, mechanical steer about where rates are going. We know that's never a good idea. So, you know, that was the purpose of that discussion. And obviously, you know, and I think I sort of took it from your piece, really. You know, I'm not sure we were saying anything terribly deep in that respect, other than to say we're alert and policy is ready to act if it needs to.
Okay, sure. And look, I'm certainly not going to get you to speculate on the outlook for rates. I mean, that's the job of all us in the room to do. But in the context, I guess, of policy responding and thinking, you know, if policy was to respond in terms of easing, a lot of focus then I think would come on to this idea of neutral, or where is neutral in Australia and where does policy ultimately land, where it's neither restrictive or stimulatory. And on that, I noticed in the August Statement of Monetary Policy, there was a chart which had the bank's estimate of the nominal neutral interest rate. And it looks like the point estimate is around 3.5%. But I think what stood out to me was that there was a range of kind of model estimates in that chart, and it was basically presented then as a range to the point estimate. And the range is quite narrow over the last 18 months or so in terms of the estimates of nominal neutral relative to pre-pandemic, where the range was quite large. So does that mean that the bank is more confident now around where the nominal neutral rate might be? And if so, does that feed into your current thinking of how restrictive policy may or may not be? Or do you still lean into the actual data to help work out, you know, how restrictive policy actually is?
So that, and probably not everyone in the room has that chart in their heads. But to the short answer to your question, are we now more certain about where our SAR is no.
Okay.
And in fact, anyone that says that they're confident about our SAR is, you know, you should probably have their head examined, because you can't be very confident.
Well, I'm not confident at all.
No, indeed. So the reason, just that chart, and as I say, I'll probably lose 2/3 of the room here, but that chart showed a range of different estimates of our SAR, the central case from 3 or 4 different models, and
yep.
I think we described the models at least in outline in a footnote. I don't think I'm giving you any secrets to say most of the models are clustered around that sort of number, whatever you described, you know, somewhere between 3 and 4. There's one model that tends to walk around quite a lot. And, you know, we include that because it might be right and the others might be wrong. And as you know, you can form an estimate of RSR in different ways. You can go and read it off market forward rates. You could ask what would a model need interest rates to be for the output gap to be closed and for inflation to be a target. Or you could just do a statistical model that kind of looked at past relationships and tried to derive something. And it's that statistical model that's doing a bit of a magical mystery tour around. And as it happened in that particular period, it had come in together. Now, you might ask, well, why were we showing that? I think we were just showing it to show that there are a range of different ways of estimating this number. What that sway did not account for is the uncertainty over each of the variables. So it accounted for the different outputs that you might get from models, but each of the models has a wide standard error around it. So it actually, and somebody in the RBA did it, although it's a bit of a frightening chart. Oh, gosh, sorry. It's a bit of a have I turned that off? No. It's a bit of a frightening chart because the range of uncertainty is out here somewhere. But if you overlay on the model uncertainty, estimates of the parameter uncertainty, uncertainty of shocks as well, you get a huge range, you know, far bigger than, frankly, is probably useful for policy purposes. I think what you can say, and I don't think it's just us saying this, and you and others in the market and other international central banks, is that the gap between where our rates are, where, you know, the sort of broadly reasonable range of estimates of RSR is probably smaller in Australia than in most other countries that have been fighting inflation. And as you know, that was a deliberate choice. It was a deliberate choice for us not to tighten as much as we could have done in order to try and protect those employment gains that we started talking about, and so far so good, but, you know, who knows. And with a recognition that in not tightening as much, two things would be true. One is that inflation would take longer to come back, and that's proving true. And the second is that rates would not fall as much or as early as they might do in some other countries. I could mention New Zealand, I could even mention the US, where rates had been raised much more sharply at the beginning. Now, the RBA took quite a bit of criticism for that strategy early on. I see some people in the room who perfectly reasonably said, look, we're not sure if you've tightened enough. Equally, there'll be other people now who are saying, we think you're too tight and you should be easing. So I do think, subject to those uncertainties, that the broad estimates of neutral interest rates being in that sort of range you describe helps to bring out an important aspect of the strategy, the monetary policy strategy that we do think we're following.
Okay. And look, I'm sure that the questions of whether or not it was the right strategy will be in part sort of answered next week when we see the all-important Q3 inflation data.
Yeah.
You did touch on global central banks just then, and I did have a question here related to what other central banks are doing and how that feeds into the monetary policy debate in Australia, because obviously we've seen, you know, a number of the major central banks cutting rates, ECB, the Bank of England, the RBNZ, Bank of Canada, and of course the US Federal Reserve. Now, I know all these economies have their own different and unique circumstances, but given we are in a coordinated easing cycle at the moment, is there much that the Reserve Bank takes away from what they're seeing offshore when thinking about the outlook for policy in Australia?
I don't want to pick you up on here. I don't think we're in a coordinate. Coordinated implies that there's some joint plan and that some members of that coordinating group are doing something other than they would choose to do on their. I know you didn't mean that, but I think it's often said there's a coordinated easing or a coordinated tightening. It's not true. The individual central banks are doing, I think, what they should be doing, which is looking at their own outlook for inflation, employment, output, whatever, and taking their view on that basis. The fact that rates have been broadly moving in the same way is suggestive of there having been a global shock, you know, COVID and then the energy price shock and to some extent food price shock that came after that. You know, to a greater or lesser extent, we are all responding to similar shocks, but we have national circumstances. The reason we're not cutting rates at the moment, relative to some of the other central banks, is fairly straightforwardly stated. Actually, inflation is still too high. We've said it in the statements. We'll wait and see where it is. When you look at, and I know you do, the inflation outturns in some of those other countries, in many of them, inflation is at, or in the UK, the most recent data print was 1.7%, which is 0.3 percentage points below their target. That would be a great outcome here, and I'm sure and hope we will get there, but we're not You know, we're not there yet. And, you know, as I say in part, just to repeat the point I made a minute ago, that is in part a function of a consciously chosen strategy to bring inflation down slowly to protect the employment gains. And so far we are seeing substantial employment gains. I know it's wrong ever. I mean, you said it will be resolved next week. Nothing's ever resolved, right, in monetary policy, even hundreds of years later. But it would be wrong to sort of pat ourselves on the back and say, didn't we do well? That's a hiding to nothing for central banks. But that strategy has been conscious, and I think it's well understood. Actually, I'm sorry, I'll answer a question you haven't asked me. But, I've been interested, as the data have been coming out recently, the market's been moving in response to that data, your analysis and other people doing jobs like yours, to say, well, the RBA is likely to be reading these data in the following way. And success for a central bank, well, there's many things for a central bank, is in part when its reaction function is reasonably well understood. People understand what the goals of the central bank are. They understand broadly how they'll see data. And I don't want to be overly complacent here, but I would say some of the recent reactions of market prices and commentary to the data do suggest that the reaction function of the RBA, at least right now, is relatively well understood. I would leave it to others to say if that's true or false, but that's my take on it. And that is not always true. I'm sure it won't be true here in the future, and maybe it hasn't been true sometime in the past, certainly not in the UK. But right now, there does seem to be a relatively decent level of understanding about what the RBA is trying to achieve.
Yeah, look, I would agree, and also say I think because in might have been the minutes, or there was another piece of RBA communication that said the board is putting more weight than usual on the current flow of data, that then it sort of makes sense, obviously, that the markets are doing the same thing in terms of near term. Well, data telling us how we're going is driving near-term movements in financial markets.
I mean, I think this is a tricky one, right? Because it's when we were all navigating through COVID, to do inflation targeting, you have to form a view about the outlook for inflation a year, two, maybe even 3 years out. During COVID, people realized it was so hard to form reasonable forecasts that the forecasts were, you know, many countries stopped publishing them, even those that published them were very clear that they were guiding policy less than normal. And as you say, people were, you know, intensely focused on the outcome of the data. We have to be careful, right? Because you can't target current inflation. Any decision you make today affects inflation and output out there, not here. And so I think we're all, to varying degrees, trying to rebalance away from that idea of saying, well, look, do you know what? Whatever the number comes out, we'll react to it. Well, we'll obviously react to it because that data outturn affects our view about the outlook. But it's the implication of that data for the outlook, not the data itself, that should be most relevant to policy.
Sure.
I'm not sure we got all the way back there.
No, look, that's right. You had mentioned, I think, you said the shocks a couple of times, and I was thinking about a shock that's happened here, which is kind of unique to Australia to some extent, and that has been the incredible surge that we've had in population growth over the last 18 months or so. And it's come in stronger than the government thought. And, you know, we all took the government's forecast for population growth at face value, as you do as an input into economic forecasting. Now, this is certainly not trying to be a kind of a gotcha question, but I know you've used that word gotcha
in the UK. When you say something like not being funny, but you know, the very next guy, with all due respect, exactly. I don't want to be rude, but, and then you know the next thing that's coming is someone being rude. So,
well,
yeah.
I'll ask, you don't want to have
a gotcha, but
I'll ask this as apolitically as I can. But when you look at what's happened in terms of strong population growth driven by, you know, the big lift in net overseas migration, and you put your inflation lens on it, do you think, or has the bank done any work to sort of work out what impact that strong growth in population has had on inflation? And I'm thinking maybe some of the idiosyncratic parts of the basket like rents. And you know, just to expand the question, is it something there in the short term, you know, might be inflationary, but the medium term you get the supply side response from labour? How do the different parts of the puzzle work?
I think this is a big and important question. Actually, you say it's unique or, you know, it's unusual in Australia. Perhaps it's more extreme here, but actually, as you probably know, most countries have been experiencing this since COVID. The UK notoriously voted to leave Europe, in part because some of those voting for it didn't like the number of the amount of immigration. In fact, immigration into the UK post-Brexit has been much higher than it was pre-Brexit, because although migration into the UK from Europe has petered out, from outside Europe is grown. And actually the drivers of that phenomenon are quite familiar to here. So the care sector needs a large number of workers. It's hard to find those onshore. And so companies are going and recruiting overseas and bringing people in. There's a shortage of labour supply in other sectors as well. So the UK picture, although different from Australia in important ways, is not quite as different as all that. Obviously, Canada has had a large-scale migration, and who knows exactly what the migration into the US is, because obviously the official numbers are quite small, but everyone knows that the unofficial numbers are probably quite a lot larger. So I think, actually, you know, when people look back on this period, you talk about coordinated, you know, cycle, I think they will probably, you know, as well as focusing on the differences between countries, I think a number of these things, you know, apparently very well-performing labour markets in the context of large-scale immigration, you know, will be the subject of a lot of research, I think, for many years to come. The implications of population growth for inflation, I think, broadly speaking, we think are probably relatively awash.
Okay.
You know, people come into Australia, they buy things, they spend money, but they also add to labour supply. And you know, I'm not familiar with data here, but in other countries, you know, the participation rates of immigrants are actually unusually high relative to those in South. I don't know if that's true here. As you say, it does put pressure on fixed assets, housing being the obvious one, although there are other pressures on housing as well. And just as migration has been high in many countries, actually the housing challenge, although again quite extreme in Australia, is familiar in the UK, it's familiar in Canada as well. What's going on with housing, right? I mean, demand has picked up sharply and supply is never that elastic. If my understanding is correct, Australia actually per 100,000 in population builds a relatively large number of homes rather than the small. It's sort of capacity. It's just that the number of 100,000 people is going up more rapidly, and it's not very responsive in the short run to changes in prices, partly because there are all these other demands going on. So definitely, you know, you can see signs of pressure, can't you? I mean, it's stating the obvious in some of the fixed asset markets. But monetary policy has to take that into account, as it does with any shift in relative prices. It's not obvious that needs to be a inflationary pressure overall.
Sure. And look, that ties into the next question I was going to ask, specifically around the housing market and supply. And I'll paint you a scenario where, and certainly this is just simply a scenario, but say it turned out to be the case that you were able to cut interest rates, and we did see a pretty immediate response by the household sector in terms of going out and getting home loans. House prices started to go up pretty quickly, and we have seen this happen before. And leverage started to pick up with a lift in credit growth. And Phil Lowe, when he was governor in the past, had sort of spoken at various times about concerns around debt build-up in the household sector and, you know, home prices moving up too quickly. And he was talking about it from a financial stability perspective. And there was a little bit in the most recent financial stability review around the risk that leverage in the household sector could pick up with rates coming down. So the question to tie back into the challenge, you used the word, for Australia's housing market, if we did see that kind of scenario where rates came down a little bit and household borrowing picked up quite quickly, but that was accompanied with a pickup in housing activity from a supply side, and we saw building approvals start to go up and new construction come on, is that an acceptable trade-off from a societal perspective if we see that higher leverage also result in a lift in much-needed housing supply?
Well, I've only been here 6 or 7 months. I'm going to attempt to say what is right or wrong from a societal perspective for Australia. I wouldn't do so in the UK either. From an economic perspective, though, I can sort of feel a, you know, high school supply and demand, you know, picture coming on here. You obviously do need to see a pickup in housing supply. I don't think that's a contentious or politically difficult question. The issue is how. You know, you normally in most markets would expect to see supply respond to increasing prices. Well, if I can build a house and sell it for more, I'll build more houses. that's other things equal, clearly, because there are other demands for those people and that resources, and that's been the challenge at the moment. So, look, if in the hypothetical scenario you describe, there's a strong housing supply response, that ought to push down on house price inflation, and it ought to help to a degree with the outlook for inflation. It would only be irrelevant to the outlook for inflation if the response to supply was one for one with the increase in demand. And perhaps that's quite an extreme scenario, given the elasticity of supply that we see here and actually in most countries in the world. It tends to take years, actually, debates about planning rules and all those, state versus federal and all those things that are great fun to talk about, I'm sure, over dinner parties. But nonetheless, the kind of hope not, and not great thing to be talking about that, but the basics of demand and supply and the housing supply being pretty inelastic in the short run is familiar in most countries. It takes time and effort to build houses and to get the land, to get the materials together, to pre-sell or whatever it might be, and those tend to take months and years rather than days or weeks.
Well, it's certainly a challenge for us here in Australia. I had a few more questions, and we could talk for a long time on this stuff. But conscious of time, I'd like at this point to open it up to questions from the room. Now, I think we've got a couple of roving mics. So, if anyone would like to ask the Deputy Governor a question, please raise your hand. Swati.
Hi, Andrew. Swati from
Bloomberg. Swati's been trying to get a question out of me for the whole of the 6 months that I've been here. Swati, I think we should get you a special prize. I didn't know you were a client of
my
CBA.
My prize would be you answering my question without going around it.
Boom. Okay, don't bank on it.
My inference from what you answered to Garrett's question earlier was that you are happy with how markets have reacted to recent data. So before coming here, I checked market pricing was for the first rate cut in April 2025. Is that an overreaction to one data that was labor report, or do you think that is in line with the RBA's thinking?
Note to myself is that next time I answer a question with Swati, it'll be in a year's time. I was really talking, Swati, as I think you know, about the change in prices in response to data. And I do think actually that sort of reaction of market pricing to data has on recent data prints anyway, been broadly how you might have expected. The absolute shape of the curve clearly has involved quite a sharp cut in rates for a period, and that's been pushed out a lot. I mean, as you know, Gareth, rates have over the past, few weeks, maybe even less than that, have risen substantially, almost exclusively because of developments in the US rather than Australia per se. The RBA team do quite a neat chart, maybe you do it too, of changes in rates that happen during the Australian working day, and then there's changes in rates futures, I guess, that happen overnight. And that is felt to be correlated pretty well with international data flow, which drives overnight rates versus domestic flow. And the vast majority of the pickup in Australian rates, which is of the order of 30, 40 basis points in the last few weeks, have happened overnight in response to international data, and that explains why the rate cut, Swati, that you mentioned has sort of been pushed out from. It was fully priced this year. I want to say how far back we want to go here, but I mean I think only being fully priced now for April. I'm not making a comment about whether the absolute level of the curve is priced in the right place or not. That's for everyone in this room to make a judgment on. But the response of rates to the data flow does seem to have been quite encouraging in the recent past.
Got another one at the back there. Yeah, if we've got any non-media, which is pretty much 95% of the room. Yeah, there we go.
As you can tell, I'm non-media.
Yeah.
How can we tell you're non-media?
Well, no suit. But My question broadly around the RBA's thinking, we've seen as market data has gotten more volatile, economic outcomes have gotten more volatile, and even classic economic models have gotten less predictive over the last 3 years for a whole host of reasons. With the ECB, with the Bank of England, with the Bank of Canada, even the Bank of Japan, most of these countries have been shifting themselves from looking at the 2-year or 3-year forward outlook to a much shorter outlook and saying we're just going to be responsive to the data as it comes. And in my view, that's probably more in line with 1980s, early 1990s style of central banking. The RBA, in my opinion, has gone the exact opposite direction and has become much more attuned to the 2026-2027 outlook, or right now 2026 December outlook, as compared to near-term data. Why has the RBA diverged so severely from other central bank thinking in that respect?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't think we have diverged. Your description of, as I think we were saying a minute ago, of how many central banks responded to the, you know, the wall of uncertainty during COVID, I think is sort of right, that people stopped trying to predict, you know, 2 years out and just tried to work out how to get to tomorrow. I guess we're all living our lives in that way to some degree, and that tended to put a very, very large weight on data outturns. That has somewhat, I think, reversed in the last period. So I think if you would look at the ECB and you look at the Federal Reserve, they are talking more now about their medium-term forecasts again than they were a year or two ago. Of course, you should update your forecast when data come out. It's just that you shouldn't give 100% weight to any particular data point. You might say, well, that's telling me about inflation 2 years out, so I'll put a 30% weight on it or 20% weight on it. You won't put 100% of the weight on it. You suggested that the RBA had gone the exact opposite and was looking to 26. I think that's actually a slightly different point, and that's because of the consequences of this strategy that the RBA has adopted, which is to protect the employment or seek to protect the employment outturns in this country by not tightening as much as some other countries did, and by implication, probably not easing as quickly or by as much either. That has the implication, or should have the implication, that inflation will drift only quite gradually, or underlying inflation will only drift quite gradually back to target. So you don't really have a choice but to try and form a view about the outlook when you're doing that. Most other countries in that group of large central banks that you've described have seen inflation already come back much closer to target and have responded, you know, appropriately. But I think probably if you were to take a poll of central bankers now and ask whether they were trying to move back to being inflation forecast targeters again, you'd hear most of them say, well, yes, we're chastened, we're not as, you know, sure of our forecast now as perhaps we were pre-COVID, but we're no longer doing the kind of, you know, deliberate ultra short-sightedness that we were during COVID.
Well, we've got a question from media, but which we can take unless there's anyone else in the room. Oh, yeah, up the back there.
How do you see the long and variable lags of monetary policy, given started later, everyone else has sort of seen inflation come down, your old country, well, I might say old country.
it is pretty old.
Yeah, it is. Is now below 2%.
Yeah.
How do you see those lags? And are the lags different in different countries? And a second part of the question is, what country do you see Australia most like? And how do we differ?
Well, I tell you, this last question is extremely interesting, and I don't know how many people would say the same, but go and look at Norway. Because for reasons that aren't entirely clear, I know they do have a very large share of short-term mortgages like Australia, and that may actually link to your question. But Norway is freakishly similar to Australia in its outturns. It doesn't have a massive iron ore trading business with China, for example, so it's not immediately obvious why it's quite so similar, but it's kind of a slightly flippant remark. On the kind of speed of transmission, this is obviously important, and people will often say, well, actually, Australia has a pretty rapid and substantial transmission through the stock of mostly very short maturity floating rate mortgages. When you look at the transmission mechanism in the round, though, it's not obvious that the transmission mechanism in Australia is any bigger or smaller, materially any faster or slower than in other countries, because if you like the way I always put it, this is going to sound a bit Mickey Mouse, I'm sorry, but you know, you've got a quantity of money, has to spread itself into the economy somehow. If it doesn't get through channel A, e.g. mortgages, it will go through channel B, you know, companies, or through the exchange rate. And so if you take an account of the whole of the transmission mechanism and even it out, it turns out that the speed and size of transmission in Australia is actually not that different from elsewhere. But it does show up in different places. And as we all know, reading the front page of the press and obviously in our own day-to-day family lives, if we're sort of homeowners or renters, it does show up particularly quickly in Australia in the housing in the housing sector. So I don't think we see policy as having transmitted unusually slowly or rapidly in Australia relative to other countries. But it's a good question. It's one that we're certainly keeping a close eye on.
I guess it's related to a question Gareth kind of asked around the housing market, but also the transmission of policy. Housing's one asset that in Australia perhaps will be particularly sensitive to any move in rates. But globally, as we've seen easing start, equity markets and credit markets have strengthened and look incredibly tight and or well supported. And partly, I think, on the idea that you're getting easing before unemployment or recession has materialised, and so there's a good chance the cycle is going to be extended. How do you look at credit, equity, housing in terms of the information content and what it might actually mean for the responsiveness to these early cuts globally?
Well, you're right, aren't you? I mean, global financial markets have been spectacularly optimistic, particularly in the equity market, about the probability of a soft landing, you know, really throughout the post-COVID period. I mean, as you know, probably many others in the room will know better than me, you know, the US picture of equities is a bit overstated by the behaviour of a handful of exceptionally strong performers. And if you pull that out, equity prices don't look quite as strong, but it's still a pretty confident picture. And credit spreads, to your point, have been exceptionally tight. It's kind of two parts to this. One is, you know, does it tell us anything we don't already know, or do we even maybe disagree with that view? And we could debate that. And certainly, I think my personal view is that the outlook that's been embodied in a number of those assets, you know, it has been sort of, you know, primed for perfection. It might well be true. It might well still turn out to be true, but it's at one end of the distribution. But the important point is that even if those expectations are wrong, to the extent that those prices are affecting behaviour, you've got to take them into account. You know, house prices will affect people, consumers and households' behaviour. Equity prices will affect companies' business investment decisions. And so those asset prices are an important part of the picture. Watching credit growth quite closely. You mentioned it earlier, Gareth, in Australia. It's picked up from pretty low levels and in most cases is at or only slightly above, you know, pre-COVID averages, but it has picked up. And that's part of the, you know, I think that's part of the mix.
Right. Well, look, conscious of time, I think we've got time for one last question. Is that you, Peter, over at media?
Yeah, Peter Hannum from The Guardian. I think in one of your earlier answers, Andrew, you mentioned China. That was the first time I think we heard it. The Reserve Bank, China's People's Bank cut interest rates again today. I'm just wondering, from the RBA's point of view, when you're looking at this, you know, range of activities, it's almost like a drone swarm trying to get this economy to recover some kind of growth momentum, where do you see China headed, and how is that likely to have an impact on how the RBA considers the rates path ahead?
What's the drone swarm analogy?
Well, the other one was bazooka before.
Oh, I see. I think you've written your headline already. Look, I mean, we're watching, as everyone is, you know, global prospects very closely. There's obviously important elections coming up in the next few weeks and months, and China, as you know, has been, you know, trying to kickstart its economy after a period in which there's been a very substantial slowdown in the property sector, driven by over an indebtedness, and the policy packages of recent days and recent weeks, easing of monetary policy and of fiscal policy, you know, is you know, movement in the right direction, and obviously people in the market are still waiting and speculating about what more might come. I think you've just given me some more news just here. It's a big trade partner of Australia. What happens in China matters for us, both in terms of our export growth and in terms of our investment. And so, you know, we are watching it closely. I think it's possible to tell different stories about the outlook for China. You could be relatively pessimistic if you think that property adjustment still has room to grow. You could be more optimistic if you thought that the policy initiatives that now appear to be taken, you know, are going to move things in the right direction. That is a really terrible example of your two-handed economist answer, but we're looking at it at the moment. And I think you're right. And actually, I'm going to do a speech on this in a few weeks' time. It is important, let me put it this positively, it's important, I think, in Australia to maintain a focus on the fact that we are an important trading economy as well as a home-owning economy. And, you know, I know consumption is 50% of GDP or there or thereabouts here, but if you look at the long sweep of history of Australia, you know, the periods of success and the periods of relative failure have tended to coincide with global trade cycles, global sentiment cycles, because we are a trading economy. And it's not obvious that that's going to change in the future any more than it does in the past. And I think, you know, we can plead to you, I suppose, Gareth, in a way, is that I know clients want to hear about consumption and housing, and it's terrifically important. But when you look at the longer run trends in the Australian economy, they're very often shaped by events outside of Australia. And so we need to keep a close eye on that and understand what it will mean for Australia to thrive in the future world economy. There you go. Finished.
There you go. We are a very open economy, and we also do have to close this session now. So look, I found that session fascinating. I hope everyone did in the room as well. But would you please join me in giving a round of thanks to the Deputy Governor, Andrew Houser, for joining us today.
Thank you.